Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our topic, an exploration into Islamic diversity, the mysticism of Sufism, the extremism of Salafism and Wahhabism, and Muslim violence against Muslims. My guest from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Professor Alexander Knish, a professor of Islamic studies at the Institute of Near Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan. His areas of specialty are Islamic mysticism or Sufism, its intellectual history, and Islamic movements in North Africa, Yemen, Russia, and the Caucasus. He received his doctorate at the Institute of Oriental Studies at the Soviet Academy of Sciences in what was then Leningrad, is now St. Petersburg. He was executive editor of the Encyclopedia of Islamic Mysticism and the author of the recent book Sufism, A New History of Islamic Mysticism, which was published by Princeton University Press. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
Just last week, an organization called South Asian Americans Leading Together made a statement. According to their statistics, since Trump was elected, there has been a 45% increase in hate violence against Muslims, Arabs, Middle Easterners, South Asians, including Hindus and Sikhs. 82% of these xenophobic attacks were motivated by anti-Muslim sentiments. Now, this is the highest rise in religious hate crimes against Muslims since shortly after 9/11. So we have a terrible problem in this country with the decline in religious tolerance. And frankly, it is largely due to the failure of the mainstream media to educate the public properly about the many diverse expressions within Islam. Now, this is not a monolithic religion of unified belief, as the media would like us to believe. And Trump continues to push his Muslim ban forward to the endless fanfare of those individuals who support him from the Christian evangelical movement, as well as those who are white supremacists in his base. Not all are. So I would like you to spend time this hour trying to clear away the delusional stereotypes about Islam that dominate much of the U.S. non-Muslim population and most of the media, and to recognize there are many different hues, from the far-right extremist Wahhabist to the mystical and more tolerant Sufis. And also, we need to make a sense of the fact that Washington continues to befriend the most repressive Islamic regime in the world, Saudi Arabia, while also demonizing Iran, which are both Sunni and Shiite, respectively. Now, the average person does not know how to distinguish them. So before we look at Sufism, I'd like for you to give us a history lesson about the divide in Islam between the Sunni and the Shia after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, and what are the primary features or doctrines that distinguish them and set them apart and at odds with each other. The forum is yours.
Thank you. I agree with your statements about the rise of Islamophobia and its very dire consequences for Muslims living in our neighborhoods. And this is very regrettable. What else can I say? You are absolutely right. There is no one Islam. One Islam exists on the rhetorical level. But in reality, there are many different versions of Islam, different interpretations of Islam, which are based on the same source, the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad. The Sunnah means basically the exemplary custom of the Prophet Muhammad, which all Muslims are encouraged to follow. When you hear Sunnah, you think of Sunnis being the followers. You think that Sunnis are the followers of the Sunnah, whereas the Shiites are not. But in fact, this is more complicated than that. So let's start with the history, as you suggested. The Prophet Muhammad, according to the Sunni tradition, died in the lap of his favorite wife, Aisha, in the city of Medina. And Sunnis believe that he never appointed a successor, a legitimate successor to succeed him at the head of the Muslim state that he had created in the city of Medina, in what today is Arabia, or to be more precise, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So the Prophet dies, and his followers are facing a dilemma. There are two groups, each of which has its favorite candidate, and each of which wants the candidate to be the leader. But eventually, by a spontaneous vote, they agree to choose a Meccan follower of the Prophet Muhammad, one of the earliest converts to Islam, named Abu Bakr, as the successor. And this is the beginning of the division within the community over the succession to the Prophet. Because many Muslims believed already at that time that the successor should come from the Prophet's native clan, from his family, and he should be the closest male relative of the Prophet. And there was such a candidate. His name was Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was his cousin and who also had the distinct merit in the eyes of the followers of the Prophet of having been married to a daughter of the Prophet named Fatima. So those who wanted Ali to succeed the Prophet did have a good case, but the majority of the Muslims in Medina voted for a different candidate, for Abu Bakr, the first successor or caliph in anglicized version. It's Khalifa in Arabic. Abu Bakr became the successor to the Prophet, to the chagrin of some discontented followers of Ali and his family. Said that first division later grew wider and wider, the gap between the followers of Ali and the followers of the of Abu Bakr and his successors. There were two of them, named Omar and Uthman. And eventually, when Ali came to power, many Muslims decided to reject his leadership. And that was the beginning of a civil war within Islam. So, as I mentioned, the divide grows, and gradually it acquires theological forms or dimensions, because each side begins to create a complex theological explanation as to why their vision of Islam is more truthful than the vision of Islam professed by the opponents. So that was the beginning, and eventually it grew into two communities locked in contradiction and debates over the legitimacy of the leader of the Muslim community. So to some extent, we can say that we are dealing with a division based on the political disagreements. However, this is more complex than I've just said, because each candidate also was seen as a representation of a certain vision of Islam, of a certain interpretation of Islam. So, and finally, on I would like to say, for the listeners who have little understanding of Arabic names or have hard time understanding them, that basically the division of the Shiites adopted the genealogical principle of succession to the Prophet. So his closest blood relative should be in charge, whereas the Sunnis more or less adopted an electoral system of succession. The person who receives the most votes gets the post. However, again, things are more complicated, but this is more or less the bare bones of the disagreement between the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Good. I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Because today, when we look around the world, it has become highly politicized. For example, Iran, it's a Shia country where approximately 90 to 95% of the people are Shia. And it is now considered the mortal enemy by Saudi Arabia and other countries that are principally Sunni. Now, the Sunni countries that are actually theocracies, meaning their entire government is run by people who view religion as the guiding basis for all laws. Afghanistan, Sunni. Mauritania, Sunni. Oman, Sunni. Saudi Arabia, Sunni. And yes, Yemen is about 60% Sunni, about 40% Shia. And then you have some secular governments. For example, Lebanon is 50% Shia, but it's a secular government. And Azerbaijan is 70% Shia with a secular government. Bahrain is Shia, about 70%. And Iraq is 60 to 70% Shia, though Saddam Hussein was in power through the Ba'athist Party. We put him in power, by the way, the United States did. And because we had an interest in him, because we had an interest in getting back the oil from Iran and reinstalling someone who would be like the Shah of Iran. And Iran did not start the war. By the way, most people are not even aware that the United States in 1953, based upon requests from the British government, the Prime Minister and their intelligence agencies, wanted a coup to overthrow the democratically elected government headed by Mossadegh. He was an intellectual. He was more progressive. A woman had a lot of rights and freedoms. And it was Eisenhower who took on the task of doing that. And then we created a coup. We paid for the agitators. We paid for the demonstrations. Mossadegh was overthrown in a coup and relegated to home arrest. And the Shah of Iran was brought in. With the Shah came his secret police, and they detained, tortured, and murdered tens of thousands of people. You don't hear a word about that. And for decades, the United States and British Petroleum, who was behind all of this, BP, they benefited to the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars in oil revenues. So when the crisis occurred, when Khomeini and was leading the revolution to retake back their country, we have stopped our look at history at the day that the revolution occurred and hostages, American hostages, were taken. We do not spend one sentence on what precipitated, what was the underlying cause, nor the fact that Iran is not a small country. Iran is a huge country. It's more than twice the size of Iraq. It has over 80 to 82 million people. They have a very large number of people under the age of 30. And these are highly educated young people who tend to be more westernized, who tend to be more, who are against theocracy by and large. And we never take this into consideration. So when you hear people say, bomb Iran, you mean bomb 80 million people, creating the largest single genocide in world history, letting Israel do it and we backing them? Because had Clinton been elected, I believe absolutely that would have happened. And because then it resolves some issues for Israel. But imagine what the world would be like if there was a fight. But we sponsored an eight-year fight between Iraq invading Iran, causing over a million deaths. No apologies for that. And when Saddam Hussein was using chemicals to kill Kurds, he was also using chemicals to kill Iranians. Who was supplying the chemicals? The United States and Great Britain. Was any of that ever brought up at his trial? No. So when I look at the world and I look at these different countries, I also look at them not just because they're Muslim, but rather which ones allow Islam as a state religion. Now, as a state religion, Pakistan, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Libya, Malaysia, the largest inhabited by Muslims, Morocco, Qatar, Somalia, and United Arab Emirates. So you better, if you're a lay person, you better understand a little bit of this. And though most of the other Muslim countries have secular governments, meaning they recognize the separation between government and religion, most of these are in Africa and the former Soviet countries. The more important ones are Turkey, Indonesia, Syria, Nigeria, Kosovo and Bosnia, and Palestine. So that's just to lay out the picture a little clearer today. Now, that said, I'd like for you to return to explaining about the 18th century, where there appeared a marginal and almost irrelevant Muslim preacher named Muhammad Abd al-Wahhab. And he was in the country you just mentioned, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, who during his lifetime would have been considered an extreme heretic. But he promoted an ultra-conservative and completely literal rendering of the Quran that gave rise to what is today known as Wahhabism, which became the state religion of Saudi Arabia, and it's completely theocratic monarchy. It's an absolute monarchy, and it's an absolute theocratic monarchy. So Wahhabism is also a major theological thread running through most Islamic extremists and terrorist groups. When you hear people in Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra and ISIS saying that they are killing people, they almost always moniker that with Wahhabism. And Saudi charity groups have been the major funders for the expansion of Wahhabi doctrine through the Muslim world through its school systems. There are thousands of these religious schools throughout Africa and Pakistan, Afghanistan, where Wahhabi is taught in its most extreme examples. Interesting, because we say we want to bring peace to the world and peace to the Muslim world, which is a noble and decent cause. No one ever asks, well, what if this was the United States and we said those of us who are baby boomers are about to retire from our active positions and we'll be turning over the positions of power in industry and government to another generation? Would we ever care about what they were taught in school, how they were taught, and what those teachings might do to us? Of course we would. Yet we never ask a question about what is coming out of these schools in the way of young, completely indoctrinated children by the millions who are going to fall right into the rank and file of Wahhabist doctrine and hence be the next recruits. And yet Saudi Arabia is never criticized for this. They're never held accountable. We don't hold any country that has these madras schools, these religious schools, accountable. And yet these are the fomenting backgrounds for jihadi militants and terrorists. And Wahhabism is closely related to an older legal branch of Islam known as Salafism. And give us some background on what Salafism teaches and the rise of Wahhabism and how prevalent it is today in the Muslim world. Remember, the largest religious group in the world is Islam. Catholicism is substantially below that, and other religions are substantially below that. And then compare, if you would please, other forms of Islamic theology and belief and practice, such as various Sufi movements, and how much of the Muslim world can properly be called Salafi or Wahhabi, and why has this extreme and fundamental form of Islam been successful in preaching its doctrine and winning over converts?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gary. It's to explain Salafism, I think we'll have to use the English term fundamentalism, because fundamentalists want to return to the roots of their religion, to the foundational roots of their religion, and that's why they're called fundamentalism. The fundamentals of the religion matter. So for Salafis, and I would like to point out that there are many different types of Salafis. Some of them are quite benign. We usually hear about Wahhabis. They are just a branch of Salafi, a particular version of Salafism that developed within the confines of the Arabian Peninsula since 1745, when Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, as you mentioned correctly, started his campaign to disseminate his very conservative teaching. But on the one hand, it was conservative. On the other hand, it was reformist. He wanted to reform Islam with the aim of returning to the basics. So Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab can be called fundamentalist, reformist, and conservative. But not all Salafis are like that. There are some Salafis who do not believe that Muslims should participate in political life. They oppose participation in the elections, participation in the political life within the confines of the party system. They say that this is a blameworthy innovation in Arabic bid'ah, and that true Muslims should not mix politics with religion, that religion is a devotional system. They also would like to be called Salafis because they believe that the original Islam was apolitical to some extent. So they condemn the other group of Salafism, the Muslim Brothers being the most typical example, who are political Salafis, who are not averse to participating in the elections and achieving power through the ballot box. We witnessed the rise of Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and then its sudden demise at the hand of the military leadership of Egypt, the army leadership, which deposed Mohamed Morsi, the leader of the political Salafist, and put him in jail. He is now awaiting trial and death sentence. So there are also Salafis who say we must just go to the people and preach the correct Islam and disabuse people of their ignorance or of their heretical beliefs, for instance, in the saving power of the saints. So this group of Salafis looks very much like our Protestants in that they reject the mediation of the saints, the local cults, and so forth. So as you can see, Gary, the Salafism is a very complex movement. I would go even further and say that even some Sufis say, that is, ascetics and mystics of Islam say that they are Salafis in that they follow faithfully in the footsteps of the Prophet. If you say that I'm not a follower of the Prophet, I'm not a Salafi, that is, I do not believe in the golden age of Islam under the leadership of the Prophet and his immediate successor, what kind of Muslims are you? So that's why Salafism is a kind of very, I would say, elastic category that captures so many different individuals within its ambit. If you ask, you said particularly, you talked particularly about Wahhabism, it was not stable either. It has many different shapes, even within Saudi Arabia. I know quite a few Wahhabi Muslim students who study at the American institutions of higher learning. Many of them admire American culture, American literature. They study American history, American culture, and American literature. They are fascinated by American lifestyle and American ideals. And they are, although, as you mentioned, they were trained in the same schools where they studied the Quran and the Sunnah, that is, the reports about the Prophet and his instructions. Nevertheless, they developed this interest in Western civilizations and decided to get education with the support of the Saudi state in the United States and other countries of Europe. So things are not as black and white. There are many great shades. But in general, you are right about the outdated, ossified education in Saudi institutions of higher learning. It's the repetition of the old bromides about history, Islamic history being a glorious one of constant victories, and then also the condemnation of the various non-Islamic ideologies, in particular secular ideologies, which are a bane for the Saudi rulers and also the Saudi religious establishment.
You see, that there are differences that you're speaking of that the average person in the media does not distinguish in our society. I'll give you an example. One of the arguments used a lot on the internet by different groups and individuals for not wanting Muslims to be represented in the immigration group coming to the United States is because they practice Sharia. And then they will give you examples of how limited for women Sharia is. I remember about 5 or 6 years ago watching a debate at the Oxford Union, where you can see some of the greatest debates anywhere in the world. And this one gentleman who made a very persuasive argument said that, well, Sharia wasn't even in the Quran. So by condemning Islam because of Sharia, you're condemning something that did not exist. And another person was trying to argue the case that it did. So what does the Quran actually say about Sharia? People think of Sharia as a form of strict law and a type of political governance that forms the basis for a theocracy as opposed to a democracy. And can a group, a large enough group, living in a country, any country, can they inculcate within the standards of culture identity and still maintain Sharia, or does it solidify their religious principles, depending upon how strict they are, solidify them as separate and opposed to the rest of society, in which case then you have a cultural divide? And a good example of what the media does not look at carefully enough is they're blaming, let's say, Islam for the destruction of some countries' infrastructures, at least neighborhoods and areas, because of the migrants who came from countries. But what they're not saying is, which country do they come from? They come from Syria. They come from Libya. Very progressive, highly educated, and living in a secular society where you have more freedoms and openness. Or do they come from another country in Africa or elsewhere that may be more limited? And I remember, to add just an extra point to this, I was speaking with a person who had been years ago in the Peace Corps in Africa, and they talked about the challenges of helping, you know, a society that had been overwhelmed by poverty. But the person made a specific reference to the fact that genital mutilation to the girls, not the boys, was common. Many of the girls died. This woman had a background in nursing, and she found infections after the clitoris had been cut off, sometimes with just a shard of glass, or she mentioned once the top of a tin can. And this is considered normal. Also, she said that in some of the culture where she was, in the town where she was, it was common for the women to work all day, every day, doing backbreaking work, cooking, cleaning, trying to find the food, or going to market and selling whatever meager food they had, where the men would sit, as she said, under some trees and not be affected by the labor of the women. Now, that is in that community that she saw. That was her experience. But what happens when people from that culture who have those beliefs about a person's role goes to another society that has a completely different set of rules? Then it's not a religious divide that we're talking about, but rather a cultural one where people cannot assimilate easily. And then you have the idea that within a given culture, you have people who live at the high end of the culture ethically, morally, and people live at the low end, just like our own. You can find thieves and criminals on Wall Street and heading churches and heading universities, and we have. And you can find them everywhere. It's not relegated to just poor and illiterate people, as we'd like to stereotype and make us believe. So when you look at a country like Sweden, much of Sweden's being torn apart today because, as was France at one time, because they brought in all these Algerians who did all the backbreaking work and then didn't give them anything representing a quality of life or standard of living or higher education. They just left them to be ghettoized. And then when these people rebelled, then it suddenly became their religion was why they were rebelling. No, it was because you kept them poor and completely dirt destitute and gave them no power to make any choices in their own life, even though they were in another country. So talk about this also, because this is certainly something that's important when you use Sharia as the basis. And so let's start by explaining Sharia for the people here. And where do you find it in the Quran or not? And what does it represent or not?
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Sharia, the Quran and the Sharia. The Sharia is, and Muslim scholars recognize it, is a man-made product. It is based on the interpretation of two major sources of Islam. The first is the Quran, which you mentioned, and the second is the Sunnah, or the exemplary custom or behavior of the Prophet. So the Quran actually says, I gave you these two sources. The Quran addresses itself to the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, saying that you have these two sources to base your lives on. So what is the Sharia? The Sharia is the interpretation of the Quran and of the instructions of the Prophet by later scholars. And it is very similar to the Jewish halakha. It's even the Jewish halakha, and which is the Jewish law, and the Sharia have the same meaning. It means the way to salvation, the way to God, or the path. In Christianity, as you know, Jesus says, I am the way and the truth, and Jesus is the path for salvation to the Christians. But for the Jews, it's halakha. It's the observation of the norms of the Jewish law. For the Muslims, the way to God is the Sharia. That is the path to God based on the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad. So it's a legal, it's actually, I would say, a normalized behavior of the Prophet Muhammad and the normalization of the very sometimes obscure and self-contradictory normative statements found in the Quran. It fell to the jurists of Islam to develop the Sharia. So in that sense, the Sharia is a man-made product, as I mentioned. So you mentioned often the confusion that very often takes place between culture and religion. For instance, as far as the status of women in Islam is concerned, Islam is accused of being misogynistic, that is, androcentric, centered on males at the expense of females. But many defenders of the Islam say that it's actually local cultural traditions, exactly as you mentioned, that are pervasive and can be found throughout the globe in places where there is no Sharia, no Islam, and no Quran. For instance, in Latin America, you can easily imagine the same scene that you described in your presentation, men sitting under a tree, whereas women toiling in the fields, and no one will say that they are Muslims. They are actually Catholic Christians, but the society has not yet reached the level then it becomes concerned about emancipation of women, equalizing men and women. So it's largely an economic, cultural issue that is not fully defined by religious tradition in which people live. Definitely, and you are absolutely right, when individuals with this deeply ingrained understanding of the gender roles in their traditional society, let's call them patriarchal societies, the societies based on the prevalence and domination of men, when such individuals find themselves in other countries, they are already programmed to behave the way they are by their cultures. I'm not saying that religion is absolutely innocent, because in Islam there are some statements in the Quran and in the Islamic tradition that indicate that women are subjugated to men, at least in the domestic sphere. As far as the female and male rights are concerned, vis-a-vis God, towards God, they are held to the same standards. The Quran often says the male believers and the female believers. It addresses both groups equally. But then it also says that men have a prevalence or a degree above women, which is differently interpreted by different interpreters. Of course, the conservative, male-centered interpreters would say it means women are inferior to men in terms of their nature and intellectual abilities, whereas the advocates of female rights would say no, it simply means that men are the breadwinners and they are supposed to support women, and therefore they enjoy some inheritance rights that women do not enjoy. It's not that women are deprived of inheritance rights, they just get half of what men get. But this is explained by the fact that men are held responsible by Islam for supporting their families, so they need more resources. As you can see, everything, all these interpretations are in the eye of the beholder. But to return to the Sharia, Sharia has become a boogeyman. As you see, Sharia for people who somehow are afraid that they will be subject to the Sharia. This is absolutely unfounded, demographically unjustified. There are so few Muslims in the United States, a little bit more in Europe, more even in Russia. And in all these areas, we find these phobias, Islamophobia, because many members of our societies, European societies, Russian societies, see the influx of immigrant workers as an attack against their lifestyle, who, of course, profess a different religion. For Russia, it's slightly different because Russians had lived side by side with Muslims for many more centuries than the Europeans, with the exception of Spain. But for Europeans, the influx of immigrant workers from the Middle East and from South Asia and Southeast Asia was a great shock. And that's why the European society reacted the way they did, like atavistic, deeply suppressed medieval fears sprang to the foreground, and there appeared this caricatures of Muhammad, which basically replicate what medieval European Christian theologians said about Islam without knowing very little about it, that Muslims are idol worshippers, that they worship Mohund instead of Muhammad, and they indulge in all kinds of illicit activities, that it's a sensual religion, that is immoral and faulty in all respects. So the Europeans, when faced with the influx of new labor, educated differently, behaving differently, they reacted with this medieval expression of fear denigrating the newcomers to their shores. And it's a very human reaction, but it's deplorable, and we have to fight against it. But there is only so much we can do to disabuse people of their prejudices. And I think you and your show, you are doing a great job trying to communicate the diversity of Islam and the complexity of the issues arising from the clash of two different worlds, two different cultures.
Look, right here in the United States, if you go to South Beach, you'll find a naked beach. It doesn't bother anyone down there. They know if you want to be naked, you go on that end of the beach. And even where they're not naked, they're literally the same. They're wearing little G-strings, so there's nothing hidden. And you can be topless anywhere down there. Now go to Ohio. Go to Kansas. Go to Utah, and you have a completely different cultural belief. The emancipation of women, which I support and always have, in some areas of the United States, the culture, the local culture of the religious groups like the Mormons or others or the Shakers, each one has their own particular interpretation of how much freedom a person should have and how they should express it. Look, most American Christians today, if you ask them, do you follow the King James Version of the New Testament? They're going to say yes. Okay, that was completed in 1611. How many people do you think actually were responsible for writing that? Not just the translation, frequently from languages they were not expert in. Eight members of the Church of England. And there were no original texts to translate, none in existence. And the oldest manuscripts that they had were written down hundreds of years after the last apostle had passed. You know that there are thousands upon thousands of these old manuscripts, and no two are similar. And the ones that were considered to show Jesus or the earlier Christian beliefs in a too liberal position or too promiscuous position were avoided completely at all. And these frequently became the Gnostic texts that were discovered later. And then you had the King James translator chose not to use any of these more progressive views of history, of Christianity or Christ. None of them were used. Instead, they edited previous translations to create a version that they knew would be acceptable at that time, because they had to go through their own set of censors. In other words, to get their own Hays Commission, an old motion picture rating system and censoring commission, to get them accepted. There was no discussion about what was excluded in the Council of Nicaea. All these manuscripts came together. All these religious people came together who were specifically appointed. Which book should go into the Bible? Which should be excluded? We don't know what they were thinking. We don't know why one book was accepted and one was rejected. But one thing was certain. There's not a single woman author in the Bible. And how long did it take to write this Bible? Well, over 1,000 years. All men. That means we're trusting is the absolute word of God. This shows you how leap of imagination is, that every word in the Bible by the true conservative fundamentalist is the actual word of God. When we can show that the Moses had to have been over 500 years old to have written all those different books, but they want to bypass all that. That's not faith. That is intense insecurity, and yet all the progressive thoughts, all the liberating thoughts, humanistic thoughts, truly spiritual thoughts, and that's what's remarkable about so much of the Bible, a book of Bible, of the liturgy, is lacking in spirituality. And everything is about, most of it is about what you're allowed to do to other people. So if you were to match the Quran and its interpretations and interpreters and the Bible, especially the Old Testament, you're going to see you can justify anything at any time by those in power, or you can write extensions of that based upon who's in power and what they believe in their own life. So we're starting off with the assumption that all authors of all historical work, whether it's in Judaism or Christianity, Islam or Sufism, any area, were were spiritually motivated only. They brought none of their cultural biases, their epigenetic condition biases, their fears, their misogynist views into their writing, and we know that that's not true. You can't have raping of women. You can't taking babies and beating their head against rocks. You can't have rape of all the people that you find and killing all of them in the Old Testament and say that that's the word of anything other than raging lunatics. Complete, total psychopaths. And that, unfortunately, is never discussed. You're not allowed to. You must take it in its entirety, or you use it merely as an allegorical reference point when you want to feel pious or feel somehow associated with the culture, identity within your community. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, as I mentioned already, I fully agree with you. It's a matter of interpretation. The Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet were interpreted primarily by the male elite of the Muslim societies, who, of course, provided a self-serving, male-oriented interpretation of Islam. And there are very few female scholars, although my Muslim feminist critics might disagree, of renown that we can cite. And that's because the male-centered interpretation of the Quran obscured the liberating aspects of that revelation for women. And Islam originated in a very egalitarian environment, but when it became an imperial religion in the same way as Christianity did, it changed. It was changed out of all recognition. It became the foundation of a very authoritarian rule by mostly by male, and it was interpreted against the interests of women to subjugate them, even to deride them. For instance, the hadith, there is a saying of the Prophet that was probably taken out of context that says that a community that is led by a female leader will never thrive, and that the inhabitants of hell are mostly women, and so forth and so on. Whether the Prophet indeed said that or not is not that important. It is the fact that this hadith were used to subjugate and deride and humiliate women. It's that's a truth, the truth. Also, now I would like to return to the Sharia, because it looms so large in our imagination today that for many Muslims who live under authoritarian regime, the Sharia is the last recourse. They see that the rulers subjugate them, persecute them, oppress them without any rules and norms. And they think if they return, they institute the divine law, then this divine law will serve as a check on the arbitrary powers of the authoritarian rulers who dominate the Middle Eastern landscape today. Such as Assad, and then the before him, Gaddafi, and today it's Sisi also in Egypt.
Egypt.
That's why people long for Sharia. It's not because they're just hidebound or just because they're very conservative, because they see Sharia as a way to liberate themselves from this overbearing nation state ruled by despotic rulers relying on the secret services to suppress any dissent.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies that. I know that there are many different Sufi orders and fellowships, and some of them are really different, and some are more conventionally Islamic, such as the Naqshbandis, whereas others are more interfaith and syncretic, such as the Chishtiyya order in South Asia. And some permit music to reach higher mystical states, others discourage it. Even others find spiritual liberation in breaking the Islamic laws. How should we understand these differences, and what is the united factor that different Sufi fellowships share in common? Oh, and just as an end point here, if people don't realize the significance of this concept, in recent years there's been a growing incidence of fundamentalist violence against Sufi, the mosques, the shrines, the tombs, and the followers, even the pilgrimage gatherings of Sufis who represent the mystical element in the Islamic religion. And recently there has been a bombing and shooting of a Sufi mosque in the Sinai by ISIS, killing over 300. And more recently, Sufi mosques and centers have been targeted by Islamic extremists in Libya. And there have also been many incidents of violence and bombings and assassination against Sufis in Pakistan over the years. And last year, there was the assassination of the famous Sufi celebrity musician from the Sabri family. And there was also the spree of Sufi holy men and sheikhs and their family members being hacked to death with machetes in Bangladesh. So on the one hand, this should inform the Western public and those who wish to demonize Islam that this is not a monolithic religion. It is a far more diverse religion than what the mainstream media and politicians would have us believe. By the way, the same is true of Christianity and Judaism. You have the ultra-Orthodox, the Orthodox, the conservative, and the more progressive and liberal moderate ones. So please address that.
Thank you, Gary. This is a subject that is very dear to my heart. I spent a lot of time studying, actually most of my life studying Sufism. Sufism is an ascetic, that is world-renouncing and mystical stream within Islam that is also very, very diverse internally. In my recent book, Sufism, A New History of Islamic Mysticism, I argue that Sufism contains the same tendencies that you find in Islam generally. There are Sufis who are Sunnis, and there are Sufis who are Shi'is. There are Sufis who are conservative and who do not want change, and there are forward-looking Sufis, even New Age Sufis, who practice a very kind of light form of Sufism in order to attract Western publics, the Western intellectuals and people interested in cultural enrichment. They want to attract Westerners and do not even require conversion to Islam to be part of the brotherhood. So, in other words, Sufism is Islam in miniature. It has all the Islamic tendencies in Islam as a whole, represented within its confines. To compare, to find a parallel in the Christian culture, I would say our Franciscan mystical monastic orders would be close. These are mendicant monks who are supposed to live by begging. So we find a similar way of life in among medieval and early modern Sufis who went from door to door begging, asking for food. There were more established brotherhoods, Sufi brotherhoods, that are similar to the Benedictines and Dominicans in the Christian culture. And of course, I mean Catholic Christianity, because Protestant banished the monastic brotherhoods. So these are more established orders, such as Naqshbandiya, which you mentioned, and Chishtiya. They have many lodges. They have large properties which go into this to support their leaders and the followers of their leaders, who are called the murids, those who aspire to God. So regarding the violence, we witness something. So the Sufis, if you take them and look at them in a long historical perspective, they represent the aspirations of those who did not want to perform or embody their religion mechanically. Just do the prayer and forget about God until the next one. No, they wanted God to be constantly present in their hearts and minds, and they even used a special techniques, the repetition of God's name, to work themselves into the state of mind when they become receptive of the influxes of divine grace. At least that's how they describe it, or influx of special knowledge, intuitive knowledge of God. So many Sufis were inwardly oriented. This doesn't mean that they were not active In the outside world, sometimes they thought that their experiences, their knowledge they receive from God, they are so valuable that they should be disseminated among the masses. So the Sufis went to the masses and disseminated their piety, disseminated their ideas and experiences among the rank and file Muslims, some of whom joined their orders. Also, Sufis were active, especially in Africa, India, and Indonesia, in propagating Islam as a religion. They came to the communities that were non-Islamic, animists or Buddhists, or even in some areas Christians, and were able to lead those communities to accept Islam as their primary source of identity. So sometimes Sufis are described as hoplites of Islam, that is, foot soldiers of Islam in India, Indonesia, Central Asia, Africa. Throughout Africa, Sufis have been very
Alexander, we're out of time, but what I'd like to do is invite you back just to have a more in-depth discussion on Sufism, all right?
That's great. Thank you, Gary, for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you and to your listeners.
And remember, my guest, who is a professor of Islamic studies at the Institute for Near Eastern Studies, University of Michigan, is also one of the world's leading authorities on Sufism and Islam. And he also has a book out, and I would highly recommend people read it because it takes you to a different level of understanding, called Sufism, A New History of Islamic Mysticism, commissioned by Princeton University Press. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Professor Alexander Knysh, K-N-Y-S-H. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.